Welcome to Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And today my guest is Fred Magdoff. Fred is Professor Emeritus in Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and he's Adjunct Professor of Crops and Soils at Cornell University. Oh, we had a Cornell University guest on yesterday from the medical college. Listeners know we talked about universal health care with Oliver Fine. Oh, we will get into a lot of things today. Fred is an expert on food and human health. He's also a director of the Monthly Review Foundation. I strongly recommend the website monthlyreview.org the way I do. globalresearch.ca. These are places people need to go to find out what really is going on and read the contributions of the important contributors to these sites. Call it the antidote to CNN, to Fox News, to BBC, to the rest of them. Oh, excuse me, a little frog in my throat. Fred is also co-author with John Bellamy Foster, who was on this program 3-4 weeks ago. Their most recent book is titled The Great Financial Crash. Crisis, I'm sorry. Well, crash indeed. Crisis, crash, it really is both. Subtitle, Causes and Consequences. Oh, indeed so. It's a topic that we revisit all the time on this program, and we did with John when he was on. Fred, I welcome you to the program.
Thanks. Pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's a great honor to have you on, as it was having John on. And food, human health, global food crisis. I might mention that about a year ago, I wrote an article. You deal with this all the time. I'm kind of eclectic. I go in lots of directions in what I do. But about a year ago, I wrote an article called Global Food Crisis: Hunger, Plagues, Haiti, and the World. I focused on Haiti, but I reviewed what was going on as food prices were rocketing and people were starving to death. And it's a lovely system that we have. It rewards the people who manipulate markets to satisfy their greed, and they don't have any qualm in the world whether they starve people to death doing it. But maybe we can talk about those things and the global crisis and so on. And you're an expert, so I rely on people like you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, on the food crisis or just in general what's happening?
Well, food and the global crisis. You've got a new book, and it's a
right.
Crucially important topic for me. So I'd love to talk more about that as well.
That's fine. Just a little bit on the food crisis, maybe before we get into the current economic situation with the financial crisis, the crisis of the economy, et cetera. As you mentioned, the food prices just skyrocketed in 2008. Well, it actually started going up in some commodities at the end of 2006 and then went up in 2007 and just went crazy in 2008. And there were a number of reasons that caused that, which, if you'd like to, I can go into later.
Oh, indeed. Let me just alert you. When we hear soft music, it means there's a break coming, and I'll interrupt, and then we'll pick it right up when we come back. But oh, do I hear it? You're playing our song, Fred. let's take a break, and then we'll come back. And absolutely, the causes are very, very crucial to review.
Okay.
We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
To the News Hour. I'm on with Fred Magdoff. Let's talk about the causes, Fred, that caused food prices to ratchet up. The same thing that happens with all commodities, but please list the reasons that you feel are important.
Well, this is now referring to what happened last year and really 2007, 2008. And the food crisis really isn't over, by the way. Prices are down, but they're still quite a bit higher than they were, just 3-4 years ago. So people are still having a hard time of it in many countries. But what happened in 2007, 2008 was you had a combination of things which caused the occurrences which caused the market to be fairly tight. One of those was a longstanding phenomenon, which was more people were eating more meat, essentially. This was in the Western world as well as in the developing country where you were having a new middle class developing, like in China. And as they ate more meat, there was more grain, corn mainly, and soybeans, the oil, an oil grain, an oil seed, that is used as animal feed. So more of what was being grown in terms of starchy material and oil and protein was being diverted to produce animals. So that was one aspect. And that had been going on for a long time. But you also had a development which was only maybe 4 or 5 years old, which was this tremendous increase in the use of food for making fuel, what's called biofuels or agrofuels. And in the United States, this is mainly the use of corn to make ethanol, corn grain to make ethanol, which is then put in almost all of the gasoline you buy nowadays that has to have 10% ethanol in it. You can make ethanol from other, the Brazilians are making it from sugar cane. And then the Europeans have placed more emphasis on biodiesel, and they were getting their oil source to make the biodiesel from palm oil, the oil palm tree grown in Malaysia, Indonesia, mainly in that neck of the woods. But that oil is also used as a cooking oil. So a lot of people got displaced, farmers, but also the prices just went tremendously high because the Europeans were buying so much of the palm oil to use as to turn into biodiesel. So this is another aspect of causing a tight market to develop in some of the major food crops. And then you also had some bad conditions in a few countries. Australia has had a drought for a number of years. They've been a major exporter in the past of wheat and, of all things, rice, which I don't think they export anymore because they just don't have the water to grow it, and a number of other countries. So you had markets that were tight, but there was still enough food to feed everybody on a world basis. But what happened was then the speculators got in. This is what always happens when the markets get tight. The speculators go to work. On the local level, you call it hoarding, when a merchant just holds on to, you know, whatever the product is with the hope that the price will be higher tomorrow or next week than it is today. And what happens now larger level is the speculators getting into the commodity markets and driving up prices. And at one point, it was March of last year, 2008, about a year ago, about half of all of the grain in the United States that was actually present in storage from the last summer's crop mainly was controlled by speculators. That's the extent. I mean, that's how much it was. And the prices just shot up unbelievably and reached, by June, they reached just unbelievable heights, about double where they are right now for corn and for soybeans and wheat and things like that. So, and then the market for many of the commodities started to crash as the beginnings of the recession started to set in. So, and the speculators wanted to get out quickly. And then of course you have maldistribution, which is another reason for the crisis. If you don't have a lot of money, or if you don't have money to buy food, you don't have what the economists refer to as effective demand. So you need it to live, and your kids need it to live, but you just don't have the money to buy it. And you were mentioning that you had written about Haiti, and the price of rice went up there. First it doubled, then I think it went up another 50%. And it just, if people are spending already 70-80% of their income on food, and the price of food doubles, they just don't have the money to buy it.
To me, Haiti is really a poster child for what goes on in poor, impoverished countries. I just took a special interest in Haiti. I've written a few times about it as far as food went. Way back before all of this stuff began, Haiti was very self-sufficient in rice production. But enter the WTO rules, or really Washington rules, and with big subsidies to the ag giants, incomes subsidized imported rice. Haitian farmers get priced out of the market. The price shoots way, way up. And Haiti is such a poor country, even under ideal conditions. And the only good years it really had were the short period under Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the first term of René Préval, not the current term, where he's really controlled by Washington, by the U.N. occupation force. And I wrote about how Haitians, I mean, they're literally starving to death, many people, terribly undernourished, and they're forced to eat what they call mud cookies, devoid of nutrition, but the stuff apparently I guess they call it edible mud. It's hard to imagine something called mud would be edible, Fred. But
well, it's literally soil that they bake. They put a little salt in it and a little bit of shortening, but it's essentially soil. I mean, it's essentially mud, right?
But it's full of bacteria, and there's no real nutrition in it. So I guess it amounts to stomach filler. And little more than that, but I mean, imagine people where you live or where I live going to the market and buying edible mud to cook up a meal. And it's not free. I mean, they have to pay for this stuff.
That's right.
I forget the price, maybe a certain number of cookies, maybe $1 or $1.50. But Haitians, when they're lucky enough to have work, earn something like 11 or 12 cents an hour. Well, who can support themselves even in Haiti on 11 or 12 cents an hour? It's a terrible situation. But then you get these prices rocketing up. It caused riots in Haiti.
I know.
And around the world, too.
Yeah. You know, if your viewers are interested just in what can happen to a country's agriculture under the force of trying to compete with the U.S. agriculture and with the mandates that are enforced on them by the International Monetary Fund. There's a very interesting video. I don't know if you've seen it, called Life and Debt, D-E-B-T.
No, I have not seen it.
Which is about it's about Jamaica, the island of Jamaica, and it focuses on other issues, but agriculture is central to the video. And one thing you can really see is how Jamaican agriculture was essentially destroyed by the International Monetary Fund's recommendations, and then all the imports from the United States. So it doesn't deal with this. This was done before the food crisis. This was maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, the video. But it's a very interesting video, just from the point of view of what can happen to a country.
Oh, indeed. And then think about what we did to Mexico by NAFTA rules. And we just destroyed farming for so many, 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 many thousands of Mexicans. And it's the big reason why so many in desperation left their families to come here to try to earn money to send back home and support their wife and kids. And we blame, we're the villain. We caused the problem. And the victims are always the ones who get blamed. Again, it's a terrible, terrible system. And, I mean, we need to drive a stake through the heart of these outrageous bills that, of course, the ag giants, in the case of food, the ag giants write them. GMO foods is something on my mind. I just wrote about them with some new laws percolating in Congress. To me, it appears under the guise of food safety. But all this stuff gets written by the industries affected. So Monsanto, I know, has its dirty hands all over this stuff, and they want to pollute planet Earth entirely, just carpeted from end to end, up and down the length and breadth and so on, with this GMO poison. And maybe you can say a little bit about that, because you know a lot more about it than I do.
Well, the GMO issue is an issue for the is an issue of control. It's basically tightening agribusiness's control over farmers and the food system as a whole. I mean, it's one aspect of it. There are other aspects as well, but the main problem in my mind, you know, with GMOs, in addition to the fact that and it ties the farmer even more tightly to the to agribusiness, to these large corporations. And by the way, Monsanto has raised the price of its seeds substantially for this year. You know, so farmers, I'm not surprised either. but one of the major problems with the GMOs in my mind is they do not allow for independent evaluation, and they don't allow researchers to do the research on them that should be done.
And when an independent one does it, like Mr. Putzai, if I'm pronouncing his name right, they vilify him and they bury his research, and he discovered all the harm that this stuff causes. We need to take another break, Fred. Let's do
that's
that,
right.
And
okay.
We'll continue when we come back.
Yeah.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm on with Fred Magdoff. Fred, we have a break at the bottom of the hour, then one more in the second half of the program, so we have lots of time left.
Okay.
I'll pick up where you left off, if you would.
Yeah, well, essentially, there is little to no independent research that is done on the genetically modified organisms. There was recently, maybe a month or two ago, I've forgotten exactly when, a letter circulated that was signed by a number of entomologists. These are, you know, people who work with insect problems at the major land-grant universities in the United States, complaining that the companies would not let them do independent research. You have to get permission from Monsanto or the other companies if you want to do research on their patented seeds. And if they do give you the permission to do it, then they essentially have tremendous control over what happens to the data, whether you're allowed to publish it or not allowed to publish it, et cetera. And so this is I've never heard of anything quite like it, certainly not in the agricultural area, where this was unheard of in the past. You know, there were seeds before, the hybrids that were, you know, pioneer in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, developed new varieties, and it was always made available for independent researchers to fully evaluate. You know, this was a very common aspect, so this is one of the problems with GMOs, is that there is no independent verification, there's no independent study of toxicity issues, and if you really want to do the research and you want to do it legally, you have to get that permission.
But the studies that we know about come up with very, very negative results, showing that when they study rats, I quoted studies done on rats. I mean, it's nightmarish to read through the harm it causes, all kinds of health problems to rats, and rats, I guess, are used because they're one of the closest species to humans, and I mean, we're literally playing a Russian roulette with our health by eating this stuff, and our food supply is just saturated with GMO foods or ingredients.
Sure.
I mean, you name something that anyone would eat in the course of a day, and you're sure eating a GMO food. You can avoid it a little bit by eating organic food, but even then, my God, the seeds get blown in the wind, and even organic farms can be contaminated with this stuff. But if Monsanto finds out that their seeds blew on your organic farm, they can sue you.
Right.
Patent infringement. And
yeah.
I quoted one farmer being sued.
Yeah, it's true. But I don't know if they're gonna win those. But still, they cause enough damage to the farmer just by bringing a suit.
Oh, indeed.
But anyway, so the and also, I mean, the whole point of GMO seeds is not to make things better for people. It's really to tighten control over the process. These seeds, the ones that have been released up till now, don't yield any more than any others. They make the process of growing the crop simpler, and so that farmers can grow them over larger acreages. That's why they've caught on in the Midwest, they've caught on in Brazil and other countries too, because it simplifies the system of growing. When you have a crop that you can then spray this herbicide Roundup on before it comes up, after it comes up, it doesn't matter. And then you've got some of the toxins inside it that will kill insects. And so you have a simplified system, and that makes it easier for farmers to grow on much larger areas. That's one of the reasons it's caught on very to a significant degree in the large-scale industrial farming system.
Oh, industrial farms for sure. I guess the small farmers, Fred, it's more expensive. The seeds are not reusable. So farmers, I guess, for many thousands of years, were used to saving their seeds and reusing them. Well, you get stuck with these GMO seeds, and you gotta repurchase them every year from Monsanto and the other companies.
That's right.
So they literally have a stranglehold on you.
That's right.
And I guess once you get these seeds in the ground, the soil is polluted by them, and if you wanted to use something else, it wouldn't work the same as before you ever used these seeds. Is that right?
Well, I'm not too worried about that. There certainly is evidence that some of the toxins, for example, with the BT corn, and they engineer the toxin that's in this particular bacteria into the corn, so that it's in all of the parts of the corn, so that it's an insecticide. In essence, they say they're using less insecticide, but what they've done is they've made every cell of the plant produce an insecticide. So they're not spraying it. It's the plant has been genetically changed to produce its own pesticide. And so some of that resides in the soil. It does reside in the soil. There was some work that showed them that at least for 6 months, they didn't even check after that, it was still present in the soil. This is from these BT varieties, which is Bacillus thuringiensis, is the name of the bacteria that the toxin comes from originally.
We have to take another break, and of course, the BT variety is another GM product, and it just sends chills through me to think about putting this stuff in my body. But let's take a break, and we'll be right back, Fred.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Fred Magdoff. Fred, we really need all day to get into all of these big issues. I would love to talk about your book again, The Great Financial Crisis, Causes and Consequences. Should we do that for a while?
Sure.
Let me just mention one thing. There was a very lengthy and interesting article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, an opinion piece, written by two men. I must say I'm unfamiliar with them, but one is an economics Nobel laureate, Vernon Smith, and the other, Stephen Gerstad. And they pretty much, they're very concerned about what's going on and critical. And they question the accepted ideology that, we learned our lessons back in that recession that became the Great Depression. We did the wrong things, and we didn't throw enough money at it quick enough. And if we had the Milton Friedman approach,
right.
that If we'd done that, then we would have had a stiff recession, but there never would have been a Great Depression. And they tend to throw water on that idea. And they talk about how, that was Friedman's hypothesis. Well, I mean, we've thrown everything but the kitchen sink at this one, and we still have a terrible calamity on our hands. So how come Friedman's approach doesn't seem to be working so well now? And at the very end of the article, let me just read what they said at the very end of it. It's very interesting. They may be right. Who knows? They also say that, the only way we're going to figure out what the real cause then and what the real cause now is with a lot more study than we've done. But we just have to forget about just accepting the Chicago school approach that, well, this is the way it was, and we know the reasons, and we know the solutions. Because very possibly they're not the solutions. So they say, the hypothesis we propose, and they're not saying conclusion, the hypothesis is that a financial crisis that originates in consumer debt, there was an overage of it back in the 1920s at the end of the decade, and certainly in the current situation. So a financial crisis that originates in consumer debt, especially consumer debt concentrated at the low end of the wealth and income distribution, the great masses of the population, it could be transmitted quickly and forcefully into the financial system. And then their last line is, it appears that we're witnessing the second great consumer debt crash, the end of a massive consumption binge. Well, I think we certainly are, and it's just a question of how bad is this going to be, and how deep will it run, and how much damage will it do, and are we in another Great Depression, and I guess we'll have to let it run for a while and evaluate it in hindsight. But we very well may be, and I think somewhere they at least hinted that very possibly this thing is so bad it might end up worse than the first one.
Yeah, I mean, it's still not clear what's, well, obviously, there are very few people that have crystal balls nowadays, or at least accurate ones. Yeah, they're right. I agree with some of. I did read the article yesterday, and I agree with some of what they had to say. And they're absolutely right about the tremendous amount of debt that was taken on by consumers relative to the economy. In other words, it wasn't just year after year increasing debt, but relative to the underlying economy. But that's not the only debt that was occurring. By the end of 2007, you had the total consumer debt in the United States. So that is, for credit cards, for cars, for their mortgages, which is a major one, was approximately 100% of the gross domestic product, the GDP, which is the summation of everything produced, all services and goods in the United States for a year. And it had gone up tremendously as a percent of the GDP over the last 20, 30 years. But partially, this is a response of people to stagnating wages. They took on more debts in order to be able to keep a standard of living or to increase their standard of living. Also, you had more, dual earning families, many women coming into the labor force over the last 20, 25, 30 years, and you also had people working longer hours and taking on a second job or part-time or full-time job in order to be able to make ends meet. This debt is a real phenomenon, and it's what kept the economy going, was increasing consumer debt and also increase in corporate debt, which I'll get to in a second. Consumer debt, which was consumer purchases, which were something like 60% of the gross domestic product, 20 years ago, was recently, that is 2007, 2008, 70%. So the consumers' purchases became more important in keeping the economy going, and actually that's one of the reasons why the economy did keep going, was people were just purchasing more stuff of all different types.
Indeed.
So that is true. But you also had actually a larger growth of debt on the corporate side, especially the financial debt. And financial debt at the end of 2007 was approximately 130% of the gross domestic product. I just had mentioned before that consumer debt was 100%, so this was even more. And
you're not factoring in these multi-trillions of derivatives in saying that, are you?
No. This isn't the nominal value of the derivatives. This is actual debt that was in the corporate sector that they took on. Mainly they took it on, they call it leverage, which all it means is that they were making bets, but they were making bets using only a very little bit of their own money and a lot of borrowed money, or even their investors' money, or a little bit of their investors' money. And these leverages could be 20 to 1, 30 to 1 in the market of currency speculation. It was 200 to 1, but what that means is that $200 of borrowed money for every dollar of your own that you're investing. So there's tremendous amount of debt that banks took on, that hedge funds took on, in order to try to juice up their profits, and their profits expressed as on the basis of their own money. In other words, if you take all the profits you made by using $100 of somebody else's money and only $1 yours and express it as a percent of that $1, it starts looking a lot better.
Your
returns look...
You don't need a big return on investment to get very rich, Fred.
You get a fraction
of 1% at 101
right.
leverage. And they double your money very, very quickly.
Absolutely. And that's how they were doing it. And so, everything was fine. It was hunky-dory as long as prices kept going up and up and up. It was the same thing with the housing bubble. It's an essence. I mean, to a certain extent, it's like a Ponzi scheme. I mean, everything works well as long as prices continue to go up for whatever it is you're playing around with, whatever it is you're speculating in. It doesn't make any difference. And the problem is when the prices start to come down, then the leverage works against you. And because you're losing so much more money than you actually put in. And you have to come up with it. And the
worst thing you can get stuck in is when everybody figures this out at the same time and they all rush for the exits.
Absolutely. Everybody's rushing for the exits, that's the case. So, and then you also just have, this pure speculation that was going on, whether it was leveraged or not. A lot of it was leveraged, but they were just betting on everything. Anything they could come up with, or making up new ways to bet. Almost every day there was a new technique. And I'm talking about the financial companies, and that they would then sell those in essence like a product. And they call them financial products or instruments to large investors, like very wealthy people or some of the funds that handle the retirement benefits, like CalPERS, the California system, the retirement system for the state workers of California. Those, they get a lot of money. So those were sort of the markets for some of these very fancy in the sense, not really fancy is not the right word, really esoteric, very hard to understand gimmicks or games or financial instruments. And the people selling them sometimes didn't even understand them, exactly what would happen under certain circumstances. So the whole thing, the speculation, the growth of speculation is intimately intertwined with the growth of debt. And so, as you say, once everybody starts heading for the doors, the thing comes crashing down. And this is definitely what's happened.
Along with this, Fred, a few times I've quoted a pretty savvy money manager by the name of Jeremy Grantham. And a couple of years ago, Oh, he did this a few times, but at least as early as 2 years ago, he talked about for the first time in his long career managing money. He saw bubbles in just about every asset class he looked at, and even things like art. I mean, he took a world tour at one point, and he came back. You could see him shaking his head. Everything he looked at as something possibly to invest in, it had elevated to the bubble stage, and he said this was unprecedented. He'd never seen or heard of anything like this, and his own internal research showed that all bubbles burst, and these prices revert to their means, but as they do it, they invariably, I mean virtually every single time, they overshoot. So what goes up too much goes down too much. And who knows how far down these things are going to go before we finally reach an end to this business.
That's true. It's true. One of the things that John and I developed, you know, tried to develop in the book was, you know, why? Why is there this speculation? Why? How come there's so much money that's not being used in the productive economy or what the economists call the real economy? You know, the economy that you and I and listeners live in, you know, where we
making stuff instead of manipulating markets
making stuff. We buy things. We have a job. We get an income. We pay the rent. We buy a pair of shoes. We go to the market, buy some food. I mean, that's the real economy. You know, there's real things there. But what has happened has been that for investors, for capitalists, it's become more and more difficult to make money in the real economy. It's not impossible, but it's more and more difficult making things or providing a service. So that what happened was that capitalists, people with lots of money, were looking for other ways to make money. And so the financial industry provided them with this wonderful way out. You don't have to make anything at all. You don't have to provide a service. You don't have to make a commodity or any good at all. We'll just make you money with money, you know. and this is the reason why so much of this has occurred, is that there has not been the possibility for people to take their money and invest it in building a new automobile factory. Well, who's going to do that now? You know, there's even before the crisis set in, there was 50% overcapacity in U.S. automobile production. There was 50% overcapacity on a worldwide basis in automobile production. Now, what are you going to do, build a new washing machine, a company to manufacture washing machines or whatever? And the answer was no. You know, some of these were being built in China because of the difference in wages or possibly some other countries. But in general, you couldn't make that much money building a new plant to make something or to open up a new business that provided a service.
This goes back to the late 1960s, early 70s, Fred.
To slowing down of the economy. It starts to slow down in the 1970s, and then it slows in the 80s and the 90s, and in the early 2000s, of course, there was a recession after the stock market crash with the dot-com bubble burst. And the so-called jobless recovery of 2002, 2003, 2004. Talk about 4 years to get back all of the jobs that had been lost, in that crash in 2000, 2001. And so it was a very sluggish recovery and very low growth rate in the economy. And on the other hand, there was all this money around. They talked about money sloshing around the world looking for places to invest. And so the financial corporations, companies, said, oh, we've got these wonderful things. We've got structured investment vehicles you can put your money in. We've got these credit default swaps. We've got, you know, all these derivatives, whatever you want. You know, we got all these products, and we're more than happy to sell them to you. And this is the way to make money nowadays, you know, without making anything.
What they did was they really packaged a lot of junk in with maybe the frosting, the stuff that people looked at they might call AAA securities, but what they did, I mean, they sold this to sophisticated investors, to sovereign to buyers, and what they really had done, they knew enough about what they were doing, and this was massive fraud. I mean, this is coming out in testimonies. Well, not the testimonies you hear on CNN, but the evidence just grows more and more. These guys ran a crime syndicate in Wall Street, and they sold this junk to people who should have known better. Some did, but that was a big cause of what's going on now.
There's a fellow who wrote a book called Liar's Poker.
Oh, I remember the book, yeah.
In the 1980s, describing what was going on then. And he says, you know, all that is quaint, considered to be very quaint today, what was happening. He was shocked by what was going on. But he interviewed a person who was pretty high up in the financial world who wanted to find out how these rating firms, you know, like Moody's, Standard & Poor's, how they took this junk, this garbage, and turned it into AAA, rated investments.
Well, these companies are their clients. They don't want to say anything bad about a client. They'll lose a client.
Well, it turned out that also their mathematical models had no possibility that they'd lose money.
Oh, we need to break again, Fred. Welcome back. I'm on with Fred Magdoff. Fred, we just have a few minutes late. We're just getting warmed up. I hate to stop this. Oh my goodness. I think we can summarize the global crisis situation by saying we really have a calamitous mess on our hands. And none, if it hadn't been for greed becoming greater greed, and what I call the crime syndicate that operates out of Wall Street, partnered with the other crime syndicate that runs our government, none of this ever would have happened. But they manufactured this to suck out their many, many billions and leave the rest of us hung out to dry. And just the unemployment alone, monthly review has a note from the editors on the difference between the official numbers and the stuff they leave out that they never should. So you've got an unemployment rate about 16%, not this fictitious 8.5%. And economist John Williams has been on this program. His latest calculation after the last report was 19.8% by re-engineering the data and going back over all of the manipulation in past years and just going back to the way we did it many years ago, 19.8% unemployment. My God, in the Great Depression, we hit 25%. We could easily hit that again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We made very well. Yeah, especially, I mean, calculated that way. It's true. The way they calculate it now, it's you're not unemployed if you've given up looking for a job because you're discouraged, because you're not considered to be part of the labor force. Therefore, you can't be, by definition, unemployed.
And if you work 1 hour a month, you consider it employed.
That's right. That's right.
Maybe babysitting for an hour a month, and you consider it employed.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, it's crazy. And of course, this is the stuff they go with, and the markets trade on, and everyone says, hallelujah, it could have been worse.
Right. But I want to just raise one point. There's no question that that the financial interests saw a way to make a killing, and that they worked hand in glove with the political establishment, Republicans and Democrats, didn't make any difference, in order to get bills through Congress and to loosen regulations, et cetera, that would help them. But still, it comes down to the issue, the underlying problem is that we have an economy, a mature capitalist economy that is in more or less stagnation, which means that it doesn't grow anywhere near as fast as it's capable of growing, even in the good years I'm talking about, obviously, not this year. And so, I mean, obviously, it's not growing very well, and so it's a negative growth this year. But that is really the underlying problem that really is the key to the whole story in our minds. That if there isn't something that stimulates the economy greatly, and I'll give you an example of something that did that after the Second World War. But if there isn't something that stimulates the economy, when it's mature and a lot of the infrastructure has been built already and the factories are built, et cetera, the relative rate of growth of the economy is relatively slow. And just an example of something that tremendously stimulated the economy was after World War II, the explosion of the use of the automobile had tremendous ramifications. The interstate highway system that was
Ron
built.
Ron is out of time, Fred.
Oh, yeah.
We need to talk about this stuff.
Anyway.
I hear the band striking up in the background, which means they're going to break away momentarily. Can I just end it this way? I really hope you and John both will come back again, and we'll talk more about this. The global crisis has a long, long way to run. This is not going away in a hurry.
And oh, no.
There'll be so much more to discuss on this and all the other grave problems that Global Research deals with all the time, Monthly Review deals with all the time. And we just need to keep getting the word out to people so they know what we're up against and we can defend ourselves and fight back.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Fred.
My pleasure.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.